A hard man. It just doesn't seem just that I should follow Lem Bulwer. It makes me feel old. I don't know what I'm going to do if I ever do survive to 74 with an example like yours before me. But I do appreciate very much whoever is responsible for having Lem Bulwer introduce me. This is actually a moment of sentiment for me. A great many of the ideas that I've acquired along the way, I acquired from him, and I most wholeheartedly acknowledge my debt here and now. Talking about Union power, talking about power generally, calls for a certain amount of clarification. There's power and there is power. Power, brute power, and ideational power. I, with some regret, am not going to talk a great deal about the brute power of unions tonight, because I think at the moment, the non-brute power, or the not directly brute power that unions possess and freely exercise, is a great deal more interesting and possibly, at least in a short view, more dangerous to the community. I call to your minds the odd little fact that Mr. Nixon calls Mr. Meany Mr. Labor. Why? Why call him Mr. Labor? He certainly is not Mr. Labor. He's not even Mr. Union. A great many people in the unions, union officials, don't acknowledge him as the spokesman for the trade unions. Mr. Nixon calls Mr. Meany Mr. Labor in recognition of the enormous harm that Mr. Meany can do to Mr. Nixon if Mr. Meany gets his back up. And among those boys, I guess it's a method of assuaging resentment if you get called Mr. Labor. Example, then, of the kind of power I'm talking about. A power that can induce the President of the United States, who owes Mr. Meany nothing, but whom the power that can nevertheless get him acting obsequiously. The same power which induced Mr. Nixon to appoint Mr. Shultz, Secretary of Labor. Mr. Shultz is appointed Secretary of Labor because he too knows how to assuage the ruffled epidermis of the union leaders. Again, the newspapers are carrying stories daily about Judge Haynesworth from the Fourth Circuit. Well, I don't know that there are not more virtuous men in judicial office than Judge Haynesworth. I don't know. Perhaps there are more capable judges than Judge Haynesworth. But in either event, there aren't many. I have followed Judge Haynesworth's career for a great many years as a technical lawyer. I think my qualifications are in order. And I say to you, as a technical lawyer and legal analyst, Judge Haynesworth is a first-class judge. And no one has ever seriously said the contrary. As for his financial affairs, there's really nothing in anything that anyone has said about those affairs that would cause even the slightest embarrassment. Charges have been made. The charges, in spite of the fact that on the East Coast one never sees a thoroughgoing refutation of the charges, nevertheless, those charges have been refuted and in print. You go to the Midwest where there's still a certain amount of decency and intellect, you will find in numerous Midwestern newspapers quite adequate refutations of the charges and indeed concessions by Birch Bayh that perhaps his research was faulty. Why then all this fuss about Haynesworth? Well, the sole and exclusive source of the difficulty that Haynesworth has is that he has shown himself par excellence among federal judges, determined to apply the laws that Congress passed equally to unions and to employers. And this unions can't tolerate. Unions feel, and I believe quite rightly, that they can't survive unless not only are the laws loaded in their favor, but also the administration of those laws. I'll try to state briefly the condition under which unions operate now vis-a-vis the law. We can, as libertarians, members of the right, or laissez-fairists, we can live with the basic structure of labor laws that exist in this country. It isn't so good, but it isn't intolerable. I speak now, however, only of the law as passed by Congress, specifically the Taft-Hartley Act. Since its enactment, however, we haven't lived under the Taft-Hartley Act. We've lived under the Taft-Hartley Act as interpreted by the National Labor Relations Board and as endorsed by the Supreme Court of the United States. The National Labor Relations Act has had a fantastically difficult time getting its misconstructions of the law past all the circuit courts of appeals, but most particularly as it had a difficult time getting its misconstructions, perversions, and corruptions past the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Chief Judge Haynesworth is Chief Judge of the Fourth Circuit. I want to give you an example because I think it's so enlightening about a great many things that are going on in labor relations today. Among other absurdities of our national labor policy is the absurd idea that if we could only establish for industry the kind of democracy that we have generally, all personnel problems would disappear, and we'd live in the happy days and land of cocaine, to use Mises' term. Industrial democracy was the pattern that the Wagner Act first set and that the Taft-Hartley Act attempted to perfect. What's industrial democracy? It goes something like this. Workers are not to be regarded in the future as the serfs of their abusive and exploitative employers. They are to have political power with which to confront the employer. Where's the political power to come from? Well, if they want, they are to be allowed by way of secret ballot election to have unions of their choice. These unions, sitting down with the employer, will legislate a fully fair and happy set of employment terms and conditions. The key, however, as envisioned by the industrial democracy pattern, was the secret ballot election. Unfortunately, however, such are the vagaries of Americans, businessmen and workers, that unions didn't seem to be winning a sufficient number of these secret ballot elections when they were when they were conducted, even under the gerrymandering pro-union rules that the National Labor Relations Board excogitated and then wrote into the law. Believe me, I'm not overstating the situation. If we had time, I could take you through a spectrum of perversions of law that make your hair stand up. Perversions all designed to provide unions with the broadest possible scope for misrepresenting the situation in order to encourage employees to vote in their favor. Notwithstanding all these perversions, distortions, and loading of the dice in favor of unions, I repeat, unions were losing too many elections. As a matter of fact, for 20 years, from 1947 to 1967, it was a close question whether unions were coming out on top in even a majority of the elections, let alone coming out on top in terms of number of employees voting in favor of them as against number voting against them, and let alone also the question of what was happening in units that unions had once represented, or which they no longer represented. And so the NLRB, in its usual fashion, came along to give the unions aid that the law was never designed to give them. The law, as it's written, envisions the secret ballot election as the chosen method of implementing the industrial democracy idea. Unions losing so many elections, the NLRB said, well, there's no reason why an election should be had in every case. If the union has an undoubted majority and the employer refuses to recognize the union in spite of its undoubted majority, then the employer is guilty of a refusal to bargain within the meaning of the act, and we can force them to bargain, notwithstanding the fact there's never been an election to establish this undoubted majority. How then do you establish the undoubted majority? Well, the NLRB had an answer for that, too. It's the authorization card technique. Now, this is the biggest issue in labor relations today. All these issues that tend to focus attention on the incapacity of unions in a clean struggle really to acquire bargaining status, these are the deep issues of labor relations. There are the issues that the NLRB has been trying to hide from the public and from policy-making members of the public for so long. The authorization card route, then, to bargaining status was the NLRB's crutch for the unions unable to gain the representation status in the manner envisioned by the law, namely through an uncoerced secret ballot election. Until the authorization card route, however, hit the Fourth Circuit. And until, more precisely, it hit the Fourth Circuit in a panel over which Haynsworth presided. Here's what Haynsworth had to say about authorization cards as an acceptable method of establishing majority status. I'm going to quote from him now. He says, "The unreliability of the cards is not dependent upon the possible use of misrepresentations and threats, however. It is inherent, this unreliability of the cards, in the absence of secrecy and in the natural inclination of most people to avoid stands which appear to be nonconformist and antagonistic to friends and fellow employees. It is enhanced by the fact that usually, as they were here, the cards are obtained before the employees are exposed to any counter-argument and without an opportunity for reflection or recantation. Most employees having second thoughts about the matter and regretting having signed the card would do nothing about it. In most situations, only one of rare strength would succeed in having his card returned or destroyed. Cards are collected over a period of time, however, and there is no assurance that an early signer is still of the same mind on the crucial date when the union delivers its bargaining demand. Well, I realize that it's awkward to read an extensive quotation like that at this time of night, but let me sum up the significance of this statement by Ainsworth. This is a profoundly devastating refutation of every scheme, theory, concept, or abstraction that the NLRB had ever dreamt up as a means of shoring up its position that these clandestinely secured authorization cards were a valid substitute for elections. And while this is not the only time that Ainsworth has done such a thing, it is a characteristic of the Ainsworth type of jurisprudence, and characteristically, therefore, the cause of the union's really powerful campaign against Ainsworth. A campaign, incidentally, of such power that it induced the Republican whip in the Senate to not only to oppose Ainsworth, but to oppose him publicly. Now, I remind you, Griffin is from a labor state, sometimes called Michigan. There are several implications of this little affair for this talk. I think it will help to define the critical nature of union power. Unions don't have any power of their own. The power they have is the power that they acquire through this complex pattern of political alliances that has so much to do with the way the country is run. If we had not had the Supreme Court that we've had for the last 20 years, that alone, I think, would have been sufficient to remove unions as a threat to this community. They know this. Of course, they don't put it in those terms. They know that the Supreme Court is vital to their future as an economic and politically dominant power. Their power then comes in part from the Supreme Court, comes in part from the embarrassment that they're able to produce or cause the president, but these are only immediate sources of the power. The fundamental source of union power in the country lies in the fact that particularly the policymakers of the country, but also some enormous percentage of the community as a whole, is in the grip of the most absurd set of myths that I think one can find in an investigation of the 20th century mythology of this country. The Supreme Court, for example. I must tell you another story about the law. Recently, the Supreme Court of the United States handed down a decision reading right out of the law one of the few genuinely healthy provisions of the Taft-Hartley Act, a provision under which unions are not permitted to blacklist or boycott technological advances. especially in the construction industry. There's no doubt whatsoever that the boycott in question, a boycott exercised successfully by unions against the use of pre-hung doors, pre-hung sashes, pre-fabricated boilers, and so forth, no doubt whatsoever this is a flat violation of the law. Five members of the Supreme Court, however, found that even though it looked like a violation, it wasn't a violation. The swing member of the court, God rest his soul, Justice Harlan, sometimes thought of as a right-thinking judge by people who don't know what he's been doing. He was a swing member of this court, and his reason for going along with and making a majority in favor of repealing the appropriate section of the Taft-Hartley Act was that, God, in an industry where technological change and advance is so dynamic and distressing, we don't want to get in the way of unions who try to mitigate its effects. How do you like that, huh? How home building in this country is in approximately the same technological state that it was in England in 1420. They're a misridden, hag-ridden bunch, and I just to clarify my own thinking on it. I went through an awful lot of stuff by politicians, presidents, congressmen, members of the Supreme Court, and my colleagues in the labor law field, trying to see whether I could pin down their logic. You know, because mankind has to be logical, even if it's mythological, it's still logical, you know? And these are the myths that I think account for the events which, together with some things I won't mention, for example, the brute power of unions, account for the present dangerous powers possessed by unions. They'll be familiar to you, but I think putting them together may be of some interest to you, as it has been to me. They're familiar to you, especially if you've studied Karl Marx, as all of us should. They make a tight, coherent pattern, just as Fritz Kressler, you remember him? Gordon Fritz Kressler? And he'd say to me, Pietro, you are 200% wrong.
He was right.
Well, these myths are so perfectly, coherently wrong, it's beautiful. The first one is that workers and their employers are natural antagonists. The second grows right out of this one, that in this naturally antagonistic relationship, all the advantages lie with the employer. You remember Karl Marx, labor's disadvantage, Karl Marx, the class struggle. Third, employers don't have any choice as to whether or not they're going to push their advantage to the limit. They're driven by competitive exigency to drive their abusive and exploitative power right to the limit. Sweatshops. What's anyone to do? What's any right-thinking young American to do in a situation like this but to respond? Respond how? Create some protection for these poor downtrodden masses. And who? Well, of course, strong trade unionism. Strong trade unionism is in the public interest. It's the public's barrier against the abuse and exploitation of workers and, of course, the consequent depressed economic conditions generally that such abuses bring about. If unions are public servants in this sense, then of course the public should respond favorably and give them special privileges in policy and law. How else are they to serve the public as against a massive power that, in this mythology, employers possess? Finally, and we're now on number six, we encounter what's in some ways to me the most interesting and titillating of the myths. The myth of the union as underdog. Now the purpose, this myth too has a purpose. Its purpose is to ensure public tolerance of nasty union conduct. No one's going to tolerate nasty conduct from an overdog, but if an underdog kicks somebody in the groin, well, what the hell, that's just about as far as he can reach. Before an audience like this, I think it might be supererogatory to do what I'm about to do, but I guess it's expected of me to pay for the dinner. That is to go through a quick demonstration of the really crazy quality of these myths. The myth of the natural antagonism between unions and employees and employers, for example. You have to realize that they really mean natural antagonists. They mean like sheep and wolf. If there's no way you're going to get a wolf ever to play house with a sheep. The relationship is wolf eat sheep. But of course, that's not the way it is, really, between employers and employees. Employers and employees are in a relationship of mutual gratification. Not only mutual gratification, but mutual gratification of an absolutely essential kind. No employer categorically can exist without employees. And no employees, again, categorically, as such, can exist without employers. Furthermore, the welfare of the employees is intimately tied up with the welfare of the business as a whole, as is the welfare of its owners tied up with that business. Employer-employee relationships are fundamental social relationships. That is to say, it's impossible to conceive of society as contrasted, say, to life in the jungle without this relationship. It's even harder to imagine this relationship or society without this relationship than it is to imagine society without the relationship of, or sustained relationship of, parent and child. Now, this doesn't mean that I think the family relationship is insignificant. I mean that categorically, as a functioning part of society, the employer-employee relationship is more critical. In fact, quite possibly the most critical social relationship there is. The basic idea, therefore, is clearly wrong. And once that the absurdity of this idea is established, the rest falls. This is the beauty of an integrated, coherent argument. If you can unseat the premise, the rest you don't have to worry about too much. There are some marginal conflicts between employers and employees, but there are marginal conflicts in every interpersonal relationship. And there are no more critical, no more nasty, no more friction-making in the employer-employee relationship than they are in a relationship that many men and women have found viable for a long time, the relationship of man and wife. The third proposition, I remind you, holds that employers must of necessity abuse their workers unless checked by some external force. Now, we've said enough about this, I think, to reveal that there isn't anything in it. the fact that the relationship is mutually advantageous, once recognized as a fact, takes care of this proposition. There's no doubt that upon occasion some employers have abused some employees, but whether or not the converse has occurred in fewer instances than this, I don't know. If you look around, you will find that the quantum character, prolixity, and variety of employee abuses of employers doesn't have to take a back seat to the abuses that employers have upon occasion wreaked upon employees. In any event, the existence of a certain number of frictional relationships doesn't tell us a single thing about, or doesn't in any manner fortify the contention that the employer-employee relationship is inherently abusive. At most, it tells us only something about every human relationship. Might as well confront it, I suppose, that we're never going to extirpate every friction in every human relationship. It's doubtful that wives and husbands will ever get along perfectly, and doubtful that very much more doubtful that straw bosses in Russia are all paragons of intelligence, justice, or kindness. The fundamental fact that has to be realized is the one that's been put so well by Ludwig Mises. The fact, namely, that the condition of the worker is determined largely by capital-labor relationships, or ratios. The fatter and richer a country is, in terms of technological productivity, the better off workers are going to be. As Mises said, the fact that the standard of living of the average American worker is incomparably more satisfactory than that of the average Chinese worker, that in the United States, hours of work are shorter and that the children are sent to school and not to the factories, is the outcome of the fact that the capital invested per head of the employee is much greater in the United States than in China, and that, consequently, the marginal productivity of labor is much higher in the United States. Now, as to the fourth myth, namely that only trade unions can possibly check the abuses of employers. One can readily concede, at least as a conceptual matter, one can concede of a situation in which unions may bring to their senses employers who are failing to correct conditions which are remediable, first, and second, remediable at a cost which makes the remedy socially worthwhile. For example, society does gain when a trade union induces an employer to replace a brutal and stupid supervisor with an intelligent and humane one. But here again, the significant point is that, in the first place, brutal and stupid supervisors pose much, much greater problems for employers than they do for the employees. The employer's stake in his enterprise, self-evidently, is a greater stake than any employee has or any combination of employees. Consequently, employers already have a vital interest in getting rid of such supervisors, quite apart from union pressures. And the same is true, indeed, of all the other marginal friction points in the relationships of employers and employees. No one has a greater interest in reducing them to the irreducible minimum than the employer himself has. So to agree that unions may upon occasion serve a worthwhile social function does not by any means amount to agreeing with the myth to the effect that strong trade unionism alone can improve conditions for all workers in society, and check abusive tendencies of the bosses. It amounts only to recognizing that unionization may be useful at times, and it provides the basis for acknowledging a right in employees to form and join unions when they voluntarily choose to do so. This, of course, is a right recognized without question in any free society, and contrary to another myth that I'm not talking about, a right that has been recognized in this society from the beginning. To say, however, that unions are absolutely necessary to the functioning of the system is something else. The fact is that unions do not belong among the essential factors of the enterprise system, or any other system for that matter. Savers, investors, entrepreneurs, employees, and employers, yes, these are conceptually integral to the system. You can't remove them without fracturing the system. I remind you, as Milton Friedman has reminded us all so often, that it is not within the power of unions to raise wages of all labor. The best they can do, and they can do this only when they have monopolistic concessions, the social cost of which is too high, the best they can do is get for their own members wage rates and working conditions at a level so high as to amount to an expropriation of the rest of the working force. This is, I think, something that we can perceive more clearly in talking about the fifth of the myth. The fifth of these myths being the idea that special privileges are necessary if unions are to rescue workers and society from the abuses which allegedly would otherwise exist. It's impossible for unions, I repeat, to improve conditions generally in society. Strictly, physically impossible. We can't all consume more when less is produced, and when costs are simultaneously raised by arbitrary power. The plumbers, sheet metal workers, I think it was the electricians who recently struck because they had been offered only a $3.50 wage increase, were not striking in order to defend the interests of the people who live in the ghetto. They were just operating in their age-old pursuit of more money for less work. They were acting in their own interest, and they weren't doing a damn thing else. Teamsters, when they recently negotiated an increase of 60 cents an hour for 200,000 of their members, they too were not thinking of the general public or of other workers. The New York Times reported after the unions had gained that 60 cent an hour increase, I quote, "The carriers were widely expected in the union, widely expected by the union, mind you, to seek higher rates from the Interstate Commerce Commission in order to offset the higher labor costs." Observe that that increase, 60 cents an hour, from our point of view, from the general public's point of view, means $120,000 an hour for the 200,000 men involved. Still more vividly, it means something like $250 million a year. $250 million a year over the then present labor costs. Now, no one in his right mind could believe that that sum was going to come out of profits. The entire profits of that segment of the trucking industry wouldn't pay the, would just barely pay the cost of the increase. If those companies were to stay in business, they were going to have to raise their rates, and the Interstate Commerce Commission rapidly stamped a new set of tariffs. Now, I don't think it's appropriate to anyone who professes a laissez-faire point of view, as I do, to suggest that the unionized plumbers, or truck drivers, or steam fitters, or sheet metal workers have any duty to subordinate their own interests to those of the poor and the underprivileged, or the consumers generally. The only point appropriately made here is that the mythology is simply wrong in assuming that specially privileged unions are going to use their power and privilege in the service of others. Holders of special privilege will act in their own interest, just as everyone else does. But unlike everyone else, the holder of special privilege has got an edge in the struggle. Unable in the nature of things to improve conditions for all workers, especially privileged unions emerge with only an exceptional capacity to abuse others. And abuse others they do. I'll wind up being left referring to the underdog myth, the sixth of these, which is sort of like giving the suitcase an extra tap after you've got it, you know, just in case all the other things, all the other techniques we've managed to exact from a senile Supreme Court and a careless, stupid public, just in case those privileges don't empower us utterly and without restraint to hijack the community, you got to remember we're underdogs, so that if we have to burn down factories, assault, maim, kill, emasculate those filthy scabs who tend to insist that the free market should not apply also in labor relations, well, just remember that we're fighting the good fight for society and for the American Association of University Professors and all the rest of the stalwart, keen, sharp-minded intellectuals of the country. And you shouldn't really object to our using a little violence. And they wrap this one up with a final, beautiful distortion of reality. As Emil Mazie said during the McClellan Committee hearings, Senator McClellan, you're just wrong when you say that we commit violence. When we call a strike, and when GE or General Motors flagrantly insists on keeping its business going when we call a strike, then they're responsible if we break a few heads. You remember them some years ago in this great city. You were having a strike. What was his name? Dilworth, the mayor?
Yeah, lovely church.
The union were raising hell, you know, throwing tacks all over the driveways, busting windows, beating heads into the scabs, and some crusty, curmudgeonly GE guy called up Dilworth and said, "Damn you, Dilworth, if you don't protect us, we're going to think about moving our factories out of the city." What did Dilworth reply? True blue unionist as he was, a certified carrier of myth, he said, "That damn GE is trying to blackmail me." Thank you.
I listened the whole time to your detailing all these myths, but I think you left one out. And this boogeyman of automation, you know, doing away with jobs. and reminded me of the two sidewalk superintendents watching an excavation, and one nudged the other, and he said, "You see that damn shovel? It's put 100 men with shovels out of work." The other guy said, "Yes, or 1,000 men with spoons." So work for the spoons, see, and you've got to answer that argument. Are you going to permit questions, Don? Do you have any questions to...
Personally, your observation, then question whether anybody's looked at it more carefully. One of the results of living in the South, as I do right now, well, you mentioned much weaker, is that I think I perceive a totally different way of building buildings. I'm not absolutely certain because I'm not very expert, but there's some apartments going up next to me in which they're putting in prefabricated roof beams, for example. If a truck comes up with a whole pile of big A's and they just put on top of walls, and they do, I assure you, they're putting in doors that are pre-hung, at least they're putting in with a frame. And is this just a superficial impression on my part, or is there in fact a different technology to putting up houses in the South than there is in the North?
Well, it depends, Gordon. See, I've lived so long in this benighted Northeast. And I'm shocked when I go around and I see houses being built better and cheaper elsewhere, and I walk into my brother's house in the Midwest, for example, and I see all the miters and joints real nice and tight, and I say, "Where'd you get these, Mars?" And he said, "No, we use pre-hung doors here." Well, of course, they do a better job in the factory than these clodhoppers do on the job. But conditions vary all over the country. You must be aware of the tremendous growth of the trailer industry. Now, that's all factory-made housing. I don't know, you don't see any of that in New York or around Boston. I doubt whether would physically they'd be allowed. No, because the unions there have perfected all the strands. You know, the web of union power is practically complete there, all the way from at the bottom, a thoroughly brainwashed population, to, at the other extreme, employers who on the whole will not resist unions, not because they love them, because it's tough. It's tough to resist in unions up that way. And then the local village, city, town agencies have got all the codes built up in a manner such as to fortify the restraints. But there can be no doubt that turned loose, we ought to be able to build houses more efficiently than we do. How much more, I don't know. After all, it's easy to take a smart alecky point of view on this, but you want to be really straightforward and candid about it. I don't want to live in a prefabricated house. No? Hell, I'd like my houses to have walls 4 feet thick if I could manage it, you know?
You don't want pre-hung doors.
No, that's, of course, Mary, that's the whole point. If we had a free market, things would be different, I'm sure, but we don't want to get simple-minded about it. Hell, the last thing in the world I want to see is bubble houses all over the country, and I don't think it's natural to human beings, at least in our present state of development, to choose that sort of thing. It's another case of a distortion introduced into the economy by a monopoly or by a monopolistic power. A lot of technology is that way. Hell, there's been an awful lot of machinery introduced, not because in a free market situation the machinery or the capital would properly be diverted to that use, but because with wage costs artificially hoisted, it then becomes cheaper to divert resources from somewhere else into that
machinery.
I grant everything that you said, because Petro has said, but we've been living with this distortion and these absurdities and liberal attacks upon a recent society for 40 years, and we more or less survived. Right now, we're living at a crucial revolutionary moment, and I think we should put first things first. And I wonder if conservatives don't have to stop their war on the unions for the time being and welcome them as allies. Because on the three major questions that threaten our very existence, Vietnam and defense against communism, the distortion of the Constitution and its destruction in the name of civil rights, and the student and radical and black ghetto revolt, on all three of these things, the unions are among the most conservative forces in the country, and I have a hunch we've got to call a truce. And on what's really important today, to save us from complete destruction, make an alliance with the unions, and while continuing our ideological attack on them in a quiet way, shake their hands and work together. And I mean that seriously.
What do you think about the mafia?
The mafia will defend us against revolts in our streets and
well, I didn't say that facetiously.
I agree. I took it seriously.
The mafia. God almighty, the mafia says to the Department of Justice, for God's sake, why don't you get off our back? Look at me. I got this wound in Iwo Jima. I fight for my country when my country needs me. Look at all those tramps, bums, hippies, etc., marching around.
Get them first, and then worry about the destruction.
Well, I don't know. No, I can't go.
Well, it's only a matter of timing. That's my only point. But let's hit first things first. Right now, we have maybe 5 to 10 years to live if this kind of thing
keeps up. If it were an either-or proposition, I'd go along with you. I agree, but I don't think it is an either-or proposition.
Sure, it may not be the union leadership. It's our allies, but the union workers. But on the other hand, by and large, I'm in favor of restraining any attacks which are going to alienate them and get them for a conservative, respectable leadership instead of for a Waltz. That seems to me to, in other words, I think this is a secondary problem.
I don't think you have to worry about the workers of the community. The workers of the community are ready to listen very attentively to suggestions for enforcing the law against unions, you know? So that, I agree, the workers of the community are a healthy part of the community in regard to our international affairs, in regard to our problems with the hippies and the SDS. But there's no need to subordinate cleaning up the union.
By the way, I want to call you on one other thing, and I'll be quiet. I never thought I'd heard a man of yours, and I would say this not pretty seriously, absolutely clear free enterprise position use the word underprivileged. What's underprivileged about a man who's living on welfare, about who hasn't been able to get out because my ancestors didn't work at some dirty job so his children can go to college? I think that's the much worse witness than any of the six you gave.
There's that are quotation marks on that.
Okay.
Well, I've always felt underprivileged. I'd like to have more privileges. I want privileges.
Of course you are.
No, I had quotes around because they're the ones who are always fighting about the underprivileged.
What was the case that the court handed over? Was that the famous one that went after the Supreme Court?
And they reversed it. That's the one, Gissell. G-I-S-S-E-L-L. Giselle Packing. I had a nice letter from Hainsworth after this because I've been doing a lot of writing on this question, and when, as inevitably had to happen from that bunch of bums,
You know, that's a, that was a unanimous decision in the Giselle Packing case?
The reverse of the Supreme Court.
Oh. The evils of that decision are so many and so profound, it'd be impossible to exaggerate them. You know, they, in effect, said there's no free speech for employers. If an employer says that unions threaten the livelihood of workers, this is an unfair practice which will justify the board in ordering him to recognize a union on the basis of authorization cards. And Haynesworth, mournfully but in a gentlemanly way, said, well, they didn't like Giselle, apparently.
Yes? Professor, you mentioned a number of formidable factors on the union side in supporting their position of power, and yet it seems to me that there are some fundamental tides in our system, too, going against the union. One might be the basic fact that unions have become, to a degree, establishmentarianism. I think their underdog status is being somewhat besmirched, inevitably. There's a shift in our economic system from industrial activity to services, more professionalism. And it's my understanding that the percentage of the working population that is organized actually has dropped, cut downward over the years. And I wonder, my question is that whether or not I'm correct in these facts. I'd like to know, that more importantly, what you feel is the outlook for unionism in the 70s, whether it was Smith or Smith segment.
Well, you know, I want to tell you that fundamental to all my thought in this field is that unions don't have any power. They make no contribution to society, you know. They could, properly run, make a very minor contribution, but that's lost now because they're not properly run. No specially privileged abusive monopoly of that kind can be properly run. So I couldn't agree with you more. They don't have any power. Hell, unions would be trivial and insignificant in this country, but for the fact that all the instruments of law and government for the last 35 years have been shoring up their weaknesses. That's part of the thesis, you know? The unions weren't capable of winning, even in rigged elections, a sufficient number to keep them even. You know, they're losing ground. You're right. Unions represent a materially smaller proportion of the labor force today than they did 20 years ago. There are reasons for this. We've got a, whatever the hell is wrong with it, and there are a lot of things wrong with the economy, but we've got a very productive economy. And like every productive economy, it can't help itself. It's got to share the wealth, you know? Talk about communism sharing the wealth. The enterprise system is a fantastic wealth-sharing machine. Workers see this. Workers see that they get money, they get paid. You let an employer have a free hand. Of course, in your day, you didn't even need a free hand. You open your mouth anyway. But, you know, if employers were permitted to voice their opinions and state their views as freely as unions are, unions would have lost still more elections. The outlook for the future is the outlook for these myths.
He's not from the government.
Now, that's a thing, too. We should refer back to what Frank Meyer said. Unions, Frank, are a devastating threat to this country. The whole process of inflation feeds and is fed upon, you know, in this union situation.
More than by welfare?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
More than by Nixon's idea to triple welfare?
Look, unions are seminal in this situation. The welfare is consequential. The unions, in effect,
just lift that damn cost curve, you know? And then the demand curve has to be pushed over that way in order to compensate so that there won't be a tremendous unemployment. And the process of pushing that demand curve over that way is the process of Mr. Federal Reserve Board, you know, these inflationary processes that are at work. Now, I happen to believe that inflation is an infinitely more deadly threat to everything that's good and great in this country than Russia ever will be. This doesn't mean that I don't think Russia is a threat, but I think that Russia is a minor threat compared to our internal health. Just, you know, I think I'll be simplistic. I'll ride with the cliche of the healthy man as against the eternally present bugs. The healthy man doesn't have to worry too much about those bugs. The healthy, vital, well-fed man resists infections. The unhealthy, run-down man, well, he's a pushover for an infection.
Well, what good is a good economy against a massive atomic attack if you don't have the defenses for it, if you don't have the spirit to hold it off?
Well, I agree. That's another question. But certainly the best spirit in the world without a strong economy to supply the means is no good, huh? But I have a feeling that there wouldn't be a moral problem in this country if we were a laissez-faire nation, because laissez-faire is just political morality, not political economy. You've got to have a moral country if it's a laissez-faire country. And a moral country will be a stout country and won't sit still for the kind of gangsters that are operating in Russia and China. But I still don't think it's an either-or proposition.
I agree with you on that completely.
You know, I think it behooves us to keep, you know, keep our guard up and be on the offensive and defensive all at the same time.
Well, essentially what I'm saying is that I like to see the conservative rhetoric turn somewhat from an anti-labor, in quotes. I mean, I know labor is different than union, but nevertheless, the broad anti-labor position, and make it an anti-welfare, anti-radical, anti-rioters, anti-criminal, in alliance with labor. And that requires a certain change in the kind of rhetoric we previously used on the labor union. It may.
I think that's excellent.
For example, what I mean, instead of attacking, as we have many of the aspects of unionism, make demands for reforms within the unions, for example. Make demands for a greater democratization, a greater accountability. I can't help but agree with you, as I agree against all bureaucracy, against the distortion of the NLRB. But I'm thinking that the kind of things we say about the union should act as though we had come